This is a recording of the Michael Lerner teleconference with Common Will on Thursday, September 15, 2005, at 11 o'clock a.m. Central Time.
Health and the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registries. Dr. Frumkin is chair of the Department of Environmental and Occupational Health at the Rollins School of Public Health at Emory University, as well as professor of medicine at Emory Medical School. He is an internist, environmental and occupational medicine specialist, and epidemiologist. Dr. Frumkin founded and directed the Environmental and Occupational Medicine Consultation Clinic at Emory from 1991 to 2000. Our next speaker is Dr. Richard Jackson, former state public health officer for the California Department of Health Services, where he was responsible for direct leadership and oversight of public health-related activities. Previously, Dr. Jackson served as director and then senior advisor to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention's National Center for Environmental Health. Welcome, Dr. Jackson. Next, we will hear from Dr. Asa Brodman, associate director of the Center for Children's Environmental Health Environmental Research at the University of California, Berkeley. Prior to joining the center, Dr. Brodman served as a research scientist with the Environmental Health Investigations Branch and childhood-led poisoning branches of the California Department of Health Services. We will also hear from Mr. Ken Cook, who is the Executive Director of Environmental Working Group, a Washington, D.C.-based organization composed of scientists, engineers, policy experts, lawyers, and others who review government data, legal documents, scientific studies, and their own lab tests to bring to light and find solutions to threats to health. I welcome all of our speakers. I'd like to turn the call. Michael?
Thank you, Eleni. We are thrilled with the response to the call from the CHE partners. 150 partners are on the line, and we have a wonderful group of speakers here. We are very honored that Dr. Howard Frumkin is with us. He will have to leave the call in the middle of the call because of his responsibilities related to Hurricane Katrina. Our subject today is biomonitoring, the pollution in us, and I think many of us know that biomonitoring, also called body burden studies, has brought out tremendous interest both in the scientific community and among Americans as we really learn for the first time about the hundreds of chemical contaminants that all of us carry in our bodies. And as the revolution in environmental health sciences tells us more and more about the possible implications. So the question is, how do we work responsibly with this new information? How do we communicate about it? How do we talk about it? What happens when people know what is in them as individuals? What happens as the country learns more and more about what is in all of us from population studies? I want to emphasize that Dr. Frumkin has wide latitude in his comments and may address issues of how he will be working as director of the National Center for Environmental Health and the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry, and may go beyond comments specifically on biomonitoring. We're simply very delighted to have him on the call. Beyond that, the other speakers will focus specifically on the biomonitoring issue. So with that, I'd like to welcome Dr. Frumkin and ask him to give us a sense over the next 5 minutes of where he plans to take his agency and what comments he has, if any, on the specific issue of biomonitoring. Dr. Frumkin.
Thank you, Michael, and thank you, Eleni. I want to begin by acknowledging the great work that CHE and Commonweal have done to advance environmental health. As Eleni said in introducing me, I'm brand new in my job here as director of NCEH-ATSDR. I've been here for just over a week, and this is my very first public utterance in my new habitat. So I'm especially pleased to be doing it with all the partners who are on the call today. As if CHE didn't have a good enough record, CHE just hired Susan West Marmagus, who's one of the best environmental health advocates in the country, and that's a marker of CHE's success and vision. I also want to acknowledge the great work that's been done in California in support of biomonitoring, including the recent passage by the Assembly of Senate Bill 600. Let's hope it gets signed. That will be a nice example of state leadership in advancing biomonitoring. And I'm especially glad to speak to you as director of NCEH, because I didn't realize until Michael just said this that I am given a longer leash than the other speakers on the call. I certainly don't deserve it, but I'm glad to have it. So just a few quick points in my 5 minutes. First point is that biomonitoring is good. And this is so obvious that it may not even bear saying, but good data on issues about which we care deeply are a good thing. As Phil Lee said in the Taking It All In report, any scientist can tell you that in order to do good research, you need good data. We shouldn't be afraid of good data. Biomonitoring is an especially good kind of data, because if we're concerned about environmental exposures, we are concerned about how much of something may be in the air or the water or the food, but ultimately the level of most interest in terms of impact on humans is the level in human bodies. So this is an especially important kind of data, and it's a good thing to collect it. Second point is that the science of biomonitoring is advancing very fast on at least two fronts. One is that the analytical sensitivity of our instruments is higher than it's ever been, and the second is that we know how to detect more kinds of chemicals than we ever have in the past. An indicator of this is that the number of chemicals that are explained in the exposure reports that CDC puts out every couple of years has risen dramatically from 27 in the first report, that was now four reports ago, to 116, to 148, and in the coming report we're expecting about 300 chemicals to be listed. So the amount of information that we have is vast, and that is a reflection of the rapid advances in the field of biomonitoring. The third point is a cautionary point, and that is that data are not information. Data are not information. We create a lot of data through biomonitoring. In fact, we create so much data that the amount of data we have may outstrip our ability to explain them adequately. As a clinician, if I send you for an MRI and you come back to me for your results and I say, well, I have the MRI results, but I don't really know what they mean, that's not liable to be very satisfying to you. So I think those of us in the environmental health community who are involved in generating these kinds of data for the public need to anticipate that very same problem. We've really, in some senses, gotten ahead of our ability to explain and interpret what we find to the public, and that will be an ongoing challenge for us as we learn what chemical levels mean. The next point is that the policy implications of biomonitoring are very complex and challenging and interesting. It's been the case through the last few decades that a lot of our policy responses to hazardous exposures are based on documentation of a hazard. And in some senses, our hands are tied until we can be sure that something's dangerous. We don't regulate it or limit it. On the other hand, it might be that evidence of exposure should be enough to trigger policy responses. Those who hold with the precautionary principle tell us that we don't need to wait for definitive evidence of harm before responding to an exposure. So I think that biomonitoring takes us directly into a national conversation about what the policies are that govern how we handle chemical exposures. The last point that I want to make, and this is taking Michael up on his kind invitation to think and talk a little more broadly, that the subtitle of today's call is The Pollution in Us, and that is a very appropriate title for a call about biomonitoring. But the pollution in us isn't the whole story. I think that as we move forward in envisioning and creating safe, healthy environments for the American people, we need to remember that the pollution in us is only one of the problems. The way we build our communities, the extent to which nature survives and we have contact with nature, the psychosocial environments that we offer our communities and our families, the food environment, there are many, many factors that comprise the environment, and we need to be thinking about all of those if we want to pursue a global vision of safe, healthy environments for the American people. That's not at all to minimize the importance of chemical exposures or the importance of biomonitoring to learn more about them, but we need to put that in context and remember that environmental health needs to advance on many different levels simultaneously, including, but not limited to, the one we're talking about today. Thanks very much for the opportunity to be here, and I'm looking forward to hearing the other speakers.
Thank you very much, Dr. Frumpkin. And now, Dr. Richard Jackson.
Well, it's a pleasure to follow my successor, and Howie, that was a wonderful summary. I spent about 9 years at CDC and was shocked when I first arrived to see the wonderful work that the folks in the Environmental Health Laboratory were doing. At that point, they were in tumble-down buildings, but they had about 60 mass specs and one tandem mass spec, maybe two, and were generating hugely important work around Agent Orange and other toxicants. It became very quickly clear, however, that the $7 million deficit they were running every year was unacceptable. It was going to have to be turned around, and I looked far and wide for the kind of support to make this happen. It came in part from Michael Lerner, Che, Nancy Pelosi. It also came from the Rockefeller Family Fund, Barbara Levine, APHA. Many partners worked very, very hard to bring the funding in and to get that laboratory at the level it needed to be, not the least of which was the NCEH Advisory Committee, which was then chaired by Tom Burke, who did a terrific job and helped us think through as things went forward. In the beginning, we were the analytes that were being put out were generated by either who was paying for the test or, to an extent, laboratory feasibility and ease, and you know, depending on the specimens they had and the panels that they were running. It was important to then go forward and proactively select what items in the body would be looked for at that point. That advisory committee was an important process, and it was very challenging. Probably one of the biggest challenges I had was in early 2001. It was a brand new administration, and here was this large volume of data that was going to come out in the first biomonitoring report, and we were challenged, aren't you going to do this to scare people? And over again we said, no, this information is absolutely essential in decision making. The practicing clinician needs it when they're confronting someone, the epidemiologist needs it, and we were dealing with retrospective events, whether it was the methylparathione misapplication in tens of thousands of homes in half a dozen states, other kinds of pesticide applications, going back and saying, yes, people were exposed, or no, they weren't exposed, was hugely important. But the important thing about that report, as it came out, was A, the science, the data was were really unimpeachable, extensively peer-reviewed, extraordinarily high quality, and Howie's point about good data being important. I will say the corollary here is bad data is worse than no data at all. And the peer review process and the quality control process is extremely important as this goes forward. It was pretty challenging. There were half a dozen people on my childhood lead poisoning committee were replaced, and in fact, including the overall center's advisory committee, and new nominees were directly asked about their who they voted for and their political affiliations, much to the concern of the scientists who were appointed. So this quickly sort of bubbled through the political process, but we worked very hard to just keep this and make sure it was about the science. 2 years later, when the report came out, we did our best to assure that the data was available to researchers, including Asa Bradman and many of you who are on this call, so you could go to the national data bank that's available within NCEHS, do your own analysis. There were many opportunities for partnership with researchers as they were doing specific studies looking for. One that I was interested in as a pediatrician was, did children who are eating, if you will, organic diets have lower pesticide body burdens than children that did not, or who did not? So there are many studies that have come out of this. I think the third national report, again, shows the value of this. I was in multiple meetings when I was in Sacramento with people coming in. On the one side, advocates were coming in, and I was concerned because they were linking the biomonitoring data a bit too closely to a regulatory hammer to action process, which I think needed to have interposed between the finding of the data and regulatory action. There needed to be a scientific process that needed to go forward. I think that's been remedied in the latest version of the California bill. I also heard from the opposite side, and I will say bluntly, and I know I've got industry representatives on this call, that they were overstating the risks of telling people. Maybe this is my final takeaway here, is the public is much better off with real information than they are with no information. The public is much more capable of absorbing and interpreting this information than it is alleged that they can handle. I find at times some of these statements that, oh, you know, average people won't understand this, to be demeaning and paternalistic and inappropriate. The states absolutely need some of their own data. California's been on its own around tobacco issues, air toxics issues, lead poisoning issues, and many others, and the states need some state-specific data. One of my deep dreams while I was at CDC was to begin to put together state-level Haines-type activities, and hopefully as we look into the future that can happen. I've probably talked long enough, and thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Dr. Jackson. And now we hear from Dr. Asa Bradman. Dr. Bradman.
Thank you, and thank you for inviting me to participate today. I'm going to provide kind of an on-the-ground description of a project where we're using biomonitoring as a tool to look at both health outcomes and exposure and risk assessment in a population of low-income Hispanic population in the Salinas Valley of California. We're part of the, many of you have probably heard of this, the Chamaco study, which is the Center for Health Assessment of Mothers and Children of Salinas, which also stands for Small Child in Mexican Spanish. We're a longitudinal birth cohort study looking at the relationship of environmental exposures and health outcomes in children. We are not just focused on pesticides and chemical pollutants. We're looking at allergens and endotoxin, other kinds of exposures. But certainly one primary focus of what we're doing is to look at pesticides, in particular organophosphate, potential endocrine disruptors, organochlorines, and also lead. Our experience, I'm going to focus primarily on our experience communicating our results to our participants in the communities we work with. I'm just going to give you a chronology to kind of provide a case example. Initially, we were not providing results to individuals. That in part had to do with we didn't have results, and it takes a couple of years to get results back. And we didn't have a process to communicate both with individuals and the community. And we defined community broadly to include our participants, farm workers, other low-income residents of the county, county health and environmental agencies, and also industry representatives. The key that we all discussed was how do we interpret the results. And the response of our community was interesting. The medical end of the people we were working with were generally opposed to returning results because they were concerned it would scare people and also that they would then create an extra burden on the health care providers because they wouldn't know how to interpret the results. Generally, farm worker members of our advisory council and advocacy groups wanted the results back. And interestingly, the industry side that we worked with also felt there was justification for returning individual results because they saw it as kind of an individual rights issue. So there was an interesting mix of responses. Through a number of long and involved discussions and dealing with our own institutional review board here at Berkeley, which initially was also opposed to returning individual results, we developed a process that involved offering individuals the opportunity to ask for their results and then providing some mechanism to interpret what they mean and then also to meet with them individually. One of the key events that allowed us to do this and brought consensus in the group was the publication of the initial NHANES exposure report, because then we had at least some national reference data that we can compare results to in addition to various local studies. And I can't underemphasize the importance of having that resource and the ability to compare our results to that. We're also fortunate that most of our measurements were conducted in the same laboratory, so we were sure of the quality of our data and the comparability of it to the primary NHANES data. As I mentioned, we offer each participant the opportunity to ask for results. We meet individually with them, and then we compare the results to reference data. This has been a positive experience for us. It is very time-consuming. One thing that we didn't always budget for carefully was really the staff resources to conduct such in-depth contact with participants. But it has worked out, and we've made time for it. No one who has asked for results and we've given results to has been, you know, unduly frightened or scared or freaked out. So that's been a success on that front as well. we're lucky in some sense that we're looking at serial measurements of exposure in our population. So usually we don't provide a single data point. We have it over time. And often if there might be a high level at some point, at another point there's a low level, and participants can see there's variability and that a single high measurement doesn't mean they're overexposed on a chronic basis. We also return results to the community, and I think that's an important component of these discussions in the process. We work with individuals at the community level. We have a community advisory board, and we make sure we consistently inform them. They include the whole spectrum of groups down there, as I mentioned, farm workers, advocacy groups, industry and health and environmental agencies. We conduct forums with participants in the study. We also conduct forums with local community groups, churches, housing cooperatives, that sort of thing. And then we also plan to bring our findings to the state and other levels. And certainly we publish in scientific journals. We see that whole array of activities as part of communicating our results. The community response specifically overall...
Excuse me, Dr. Bradman, could you summarize at this point, because we're running a little long on the 5 minutes.
Okay. Very briefly, community response has been appreciative. There's a certain frustration that things aren't changing faster, and they would like to see action follow up on the results. So in summary, I want to emphasize the earlier points about the importance of NHANES, and then that when we take these results back to community, we do have to respect the intelligence of the people we're working with, whatever their level of formal education, and I'll stop there.
Thank you very much, Dr. Bradman. And now, Mr. Ken Cook. Ken?
Thank you, Michael, and I very much appreciate this opportunity, and it's an honor to join the distinguished experts on this call. This is indeed a national conversation now about the pollution in people, and it's long overdue. I think it's very important to many individuals and organizations that are exploring potential connections, and I want to emphasize potential connections between chemicals and pollutants and health problems, an array of health problems. The fact that we are seeing some very significant increases in certain health problems that once we account for better diagnosis, better testing, better monitoring, better classification of diseases are still real at a pace that can't be explained by genetic change. It is natural and appropriate to look at ways in which our environment and interacting with our environment, including pollutants in our environment, might be aggravating, perhaps in some instances might be causing diseases. I want to talk about three things very quickly in the interest of furthering this national conversation. I want to talk about why it's important very, very briefly to do these kinds of studies. Two, a little bit about the most recent study we conducted with Commonweal on cord blood. And then finally, to pinpoint a place to focus this national conversation now, which is legislation that was introduced earlier this summer in the Senate of the United States. Why do we do these studies? At the Environmental Working Group, one reason we do them is because we think this dialogue is very important. We think it's very powerful to explain to people not the abstract characteristics of toxic chemicals alone, but also to talk about them in a very personal way in the context of human exposure. When people understand that they have been exposed to an array of toxic chemicals that they oftentimes aren't aware of, we rarely find people assuming that that exposure automatically might explain some aspect of their health status. But it is a very productive conversation for people to know that it's okay to talk about that. There's a very sound scientific reason for exploring the potential links. So whether it is looking back over the history of public health in this dimension, whether you're looking at the history of uncovering Minamata disease with the exposure to mercury, what we've learned about childhood lead poisoning, exposure to tobacco smoke, or more recently what we've learned about exposure to chemicals that were used to make Scotchgard and are used to make Teflon now that occur in all of us. There are lively scientific debates and in some cases settled scientific debates that environmental exposures did cause health problems. This is a very relevant area for those of us who are looking at those potential links. Secondly, our most recent study with Commonweal we looked at over 400 chemicals in a sample of 10 cord blood specimens that we received through the research program at the Red Cross. These were samples that we only know the rough date of birth about. Otherwise, we have no idea who the babies are, where they were born. But this is the first time something like 261 of the 400 or so chemicals we looked at had even been studied in infants. It was the first time 209 of these various chemicals had been reported. We found 200 on average across the 10 samples, 287 across all 10 collectively. And in many instances, these are chemicals that are under intense regulatory scrutiny right now. And the fact that they are that babies are exposed to them and have these contamination levels before they even emerge from the womb is a very important consideration, we feel, knowing that there's intense scientific controversy, but also intense scientific concern about early childhood exposures. And that takes me to point three, which is the bill that was introduced this summer. Just to give you a sense of how important this debate, I think, is going to become, this is the first legislation in 30 years that would look to reform the Toxic Substances Control Act. And I'll be very brief on the one aspect that relates to biomonitoring. The criteria for identifying the chemical substances in this proposed legislation introduced by Senators Lautenberg, Jeffords, Senator Clinton, Senator Kerry, and an array of others, the first criteria that they look at for identifying and prioritizing chemical substances for study, and many of them are not studied at all under current law, is if it is found in human blood, fluids, or tissue. That is where they say we should look first. And secondly, there's a focus once if this chemical is found in humans, a very serious change, we think an improvement in safety standards modeled after the landmark Food Quality Protection Act, the pesticide policy reform in 1996, to look and see through various means whether the exposures that we find of these chemicals when we do find them in people are safe. Will they cause, can we say that there's a reasonable certainty that no harm will be caused by these chemicals individually and in aggregate? Through the exposure to a fetus, an infant, a child, a worker, or any other sensitive group. So this I think, is an important new focus for this national conversation, as Dr. Frumkin said, which is exactly what we're trying to encourage now. Michael?
Thank you very much, Ken. And now, operator, I'd like to ask you to unmute the CHE partners on the call. And I'd like to ask three CHE partners to begin the comments if they're on the call. Cliff Curtis of World Wildlife Fund, Pam Miller of Alaskan Communities Against Toxics, and Charl Patton of Commonweal. We would just welcome very brief comments from each or any of the three of you in any order that you choose to begin the conversation.
Okay, one moment, please.
Getting a lot of static, operator.
Yes, sir. I'm in the current process of trying to find it. Most of the lines are in talk listen at this time. I'll locate the static and mute it out.
So can we hear each other above the static? Is Cliff Curtis, Pam Miller, or Charl Patton online?
Hi, Michael. This is Cliff Curtis.
Yes, please go ahead, Cliff.
Yeah, I'm tied up in a meeting, and I only did the call 5 minutes ago, so I really wasn't able to hear. I really had wanted to hear the thoughts of the four speakers. Let me just say briefly that biomonitoring... Can people hear me?
No.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, we can't really hear you. Operator, if you can't, can you locate that line, operator?
Yes, I'm trying to locate it, sir.
May I suggest that people mute their own phones?
Yes. Let's
Star 6.
Do it.
To mute your line, it's star 6.
Great. We seem much better.
people to help us in trying to hold up and advance a strong EU chemicals reform policy. It's worked in terms of individuals that we've tested, politicians, key decision makers. We're right now in the final stages of preparing a three-generational family testing results that were tested back in June that will be weeks in Brussels and is generating from press and media. And it really helps us to say how important it is to have better information about the fates and effects of chemicals. It just speaks so powerfully to a core point in the EU chemicals bill that we're trying to make sure stays in there in an effective way. But beyond that, I just look forward to hearing what others have to say in the remainder of this call.
Thank you very much. And operator, I'm getting a repeated clicking sound.
Yeah.
Can you get rid of that?
I'm trying, sir. I'm trying to mute everyone's line who's making noise.
Okay, thank you. Pam Miller, are you on? And can you comment from Alaska on your work with Native American communities?
Yes, Michael, thank you. This is Pam Miller with Alaska Community Action on Toxics. And we've been engaged in a study for about 4 years with the Yupik people of St. Lawrence Island in the northern Bering Sea. And they're very concerned about impacts from military contamination and also long-range transport of persistent pollutants into the northern Arctic environment. And so we've been working with scientists with the State University of New York, Dr. David Carpenter and others, to try to determine how these sources of contamination might be affecting people, and did body burden testing. And just briefly, some of the results were that we were able to do congener-specific analysis of PCBs and testing for other pesticides, and found that there was a discernible impact from the military activities because we were able to distinguish the long-range transport sources compared with the local military contamination sources, and found levels generally 7 to 9 times higher in the bodies of the Yupik people of St. Lawrence Island than you would find in the general population of the lower 48. And I think doing the congener-specific analysis was very important because we were able to show these data both to state and federal agencies as well as the military to say that, in fact, there was a discernible contribution from the military contamination left by the military there. And in presenting the results back to the community, we met individually with people as well as holding community meetings, and that was very important. And I think rather than the people being upset necessarily by the results, the people felt that they received confirmation from what they had already known to be happening to them. And in fact, one elder literally cried with relief and felt that that information was so important to their struggle that it was in fact very beneficial just to know that information. So it was an important right to know information. So I'll stop there and
thank you, Pam,
just
very
say that
much.
Body burden testing has been very important in our work.
Cheryl Patton from Commonweal, any comments? You've been looking at biomonitoring at the community level in a lot of communities.
Well, just briefly, I wanted to talk about the California SB 600 bill because it will be the first bill that will mandate statewide community-based biomonitoring, and that means demographic or geographical communities within California will be able to have input into the design and implementation of biomonitoring studies should this bill pass. And this means that before the studies are done, which can take decades to determine whether or not chemicals are safe, and before legislative regulation on chemical policy reform happens, individuals within communities will be, according to the mandates of the bill, told their individual results and receive counseling. Now, we know that data is complex and very complicated, and people will be learning to deal with that complexity and uncertainty. But nevertheless, it will provide them with information to make personal choices. They may choose to shop differently. It may encourage them to become politically active. It may encourage them to push for more research and to support the biomonitoring work in California to establish a California Haines, which would be enormously useful. So I think we're seeing all that we've learned from different kinds of community monitoring around the country and in Europe are providing models for what might happen in California. Now, the bill is on its way to its governor's desk. The bill has been removed from the Chamber of Commerce job killer list. They've removed their objections and gone into a neutral position. CDC has promised $1.5 to $2 million support for the bill to help us get jump started. So we're just very much hoping the governor will do the right thing and support the bill.
Thank you. And I just want to underscore the tremendous leadership of the Breast Cancer Fund in moving the bill through the legislature. Really wonderful leadership from one of the founding CHAPE partners. So we're now open for other comments and questions. Please identify yourself before you speak and keep the questions brief.
This is Sandy Ross, Health and Habitat. I'm wondering that if there are any chemicals that show up enough to become a candidate for litigation.
Ken Cook, would you like to respond to that?
A great deal of biomonitoring work that relates to litigation, but in most cases, just the presence of a chemical is not adequate unless all the harm can be shown to pursue litigation for a damage to human health. If it's damage to resources, the standard is lower legally. But the best known example, of course, where litigation has come into play, or where you have a toxin that's been extremely well studied. In some cases, but not all, banned, or at least severely restricted. And there's nonetheless been exposures that have happened to individuals, and they've gone to court. Two good examples of that are lead, where people have taken landlords to court for failing to protect them, or paint companies, and of course, asbestos, where there's no dispute really about the potential of the material to cause mesothelioma or asbestosis, and in some cases very strong evidence has been used, and people have won cases for lung cancer. But primarily these are pieces of a litigation story, and I think a lot of companies worry about that, but they rarely, except in the case of resource damages, well water that's poisoned, what have you, very rarely are they adequate, this information, to form the basis of a case unless it's a chemical that's well studied and we know there's harm.
What about bisphenol A?
I'm not a lawyer, but I don't think that right now there are many cases in the works that at least that I know of where people feel that the evidence is strong enough that the presence of bisphenol A in someone's body would be adequate in any way to file litigation.
This is Percy Jackson. I just want to jump in that
yes,
it is very important when government is deciding how to spend the nation's and state's resources on what chemicals to study, that those decisions be made by scientists, health professionals, and for that matter, the community. But the issues of litigation be kept off the table, because if you start involving all of that, it becomes an impossible set of choices.
Thank
on
you.
Both sides. I think that's how I do it. Yeah.
Other questions, please?
This is Sandra Steingraber from Ithaca. A quick comment and a question. I'm just now making my way through the 53-page PDF file from Greenpeace in Europe, which reports on body burden monitoring. I think it's called A Present for Life, and that they looked at, I think, 27 umbilical cord blood samples as well as 42 maternal blood samples. So, Ken, I would look forward to an analysis comparing the kind of range and mean concentrations of what's in European babies to what you all found. And then my question to Ken and Charles and others would be, is it your experience that when the public hears about pollution in people, that their reaction is really a function of the media in which we're reporting it? For example, what's the difference when the public hears about contaminants in breast milk versus umbilical cord blood versus the number of pesticides in the urine of Seattle school children versus a blood sample drawn from adults? And is that a consideration that we need to be thinking about in our advocacy work?
Thank you, Sandra. Ken, would you respond on the first point of whether you've looked across the two studies?
We are planning to do that. There's a lot of chemicals that are not in common in the two. I can say that for certain. But we have we're reading it now ourselves, and I commend it to everyone. It's a very good work. On the second question, we don't have enough experience, I think, yet to know, Sandra, how the various media that are tested impact people in terms of receiving the information, acting upon it, and so forth. We certainly felt that doing this cord blood study together with Commonweal, which was by far the most ambitious that had been undertaken to date, that was clearly, in our mind, very well justified from a scientific standpoint as just doing the initial survey work, if you will. And secondly, we did feel that it would help people focus on the fact that we're all in this together, even in the womb. We are all connected to our environment, and even from the very beginning of life, you are exposed to these chemicals, and we have not studied them very well. We felt that this was an important question or a point to make to people, many of whom felt, and not too long ago, a lot of the understanding in the medical profession was that babies were protected in the womb by the placenta, and that a lot of these chemicals were being blocked, or they were being shielded from harm that might be associated with them. And we wanted to try and break open that discussion.
Cheryl, would you comment specifically on the breast milk part of Sandra's question?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes. It's problematic because it's very hard to control the headlines, and the media tends to go for the splashiest headlines and say breast milk is contaminated, even though the NGOs working in these areas are very careful to say breast milk remains the best food for babies. It's hard to always get that message across. And it's curious how the media always wants to go for the highest level and try to scare people about it, when mostly the message is to say, isn't it interesting that we're finding in people's bodies not necessarily extremely high levels of this or that, but we're finding a wide range of chemicals. That's really interesting. We know that low-level amounts of chemicals can be harmful. We know that there's special vulnerabilities. And don't we want to think about what all these factors mean? And how long do we want to consider taking chances, considering that we do know that some of these chemicals essentially dehumanize us in very serious games we're playing with ourselves by allowing this chemical exposure? So whether the urgency of that message warrants putting out information about breast milk, which will in fact be read possibly by the 16-year-old Latina woman who is reticent to breastfeed in any case and has no community support, it's a debatable question. And I think NGOs are starting to look at other biospecimens to monitor in terms of advocacy work, because engaging that conversation has often led to kind of a lot of contention rather than bringing together movements between environmental groups and activists.
Thank you.
Michael, this is Cliff. Can I add a comment?
Please,
on this
Cliff.
Second point? You know, I think similar to what Ken and Charles have said, we've done no focus groups to try and get at kind of what type of biomonitoring grabs people the most. But the sort of non-objective, if you will, just informal sense has clearly been that, one, the family testing, we did a round of that in the UK through WWF UK, and it went off the charts compared to earlier testing of the Minister of the Environment, some celebrities, and well-known officials. So that grabbed people there, and that was why we sort of took that same idea and chose three generational families from 12 EU countries that are the basis for the results we'll release in a couple of weeks. And there, too, just as they were running up to this release date in two, three more weeks, the press on that has been far more than it was in the earlier rounds. And I don't think it's just a building from one to the next. I think it's the intergenerational aspect of it. And the same with the blood cord, which we co-funded with Greenpeace this latest study. So we've been really watching the press widely, and it's covered all 25 EU states much more than any of the earlier biomonitoring that's been done in the context of REACH.
Thank you, Cliff. Other comments and questions, please.
This is Jackie Christensen in Minneapolis.
Yes, Jackie.
Two quick questions. Have any of you had experience or problems with HIPAA or privacy issues in your biomonitoring? And is there a value in trying to link establishing disease registries with biomonitoring and vice versa?
I can comment on the HIPAA. This is Asa Bradman. Our study enrolled participants through community health clinics, and we work closely with a local county hospital. And so far, HIPAA really has not been an obstacle for us. It's created another level of bureaucracy. We have to have additional forms. We work very closely with the hospital staff and medical records people to make sure that confidentiality is preserved. But by following the rules, we've been able to access medical records. We've been able to recruit people through the medical facilities. And although it's been, like I said, it's created some extra steps, but we've been able to get through those hoops.
Dr. Jackson, would you comment on the linking of disease registries with biomonitoring?
Two thoughts come quickly to mind. One is I know that NCHS was looking at how they could go back and look at the 1990 cohort of NHANES that were sampled and see what's happened to them, their overall health, and see that study is much bigger than just the biomonitoring part. And then it would be very interesting to see if levels have dropped or changed in that population. Secondly, there have been a whole series of essentially cohorts that have been identified. For example, the first responders at Ground Zero, where large-scale monitoring was done on the firefighters that were there, and I believe they are being followed over time. Howie might know more than that at this point.
I'm not sure Dr. Fremkin is still on. I assume he had to leave because of the Katrina work.
Michael, there is a different aspect of this, Cliff Curtis, once again. Biomonitoring refugees. In Norway, anti-biomonitoring scientists filed a complaint with the health agency saying that the WWF was violating medical ethics by doing the testing without meeting certain research protocol requirements. And they had to run that up the flagpole in the government. But in the process, we took the person out of Norway and they were tested in Denmark. The guy went to Sweden and did the same, and the family that we did for that, we brought to Brussels to test. And in the end, both countries said this is not medical research. It doesn't rise to the level of requiring that type of oversight and review and approval. But it caused us some real problems for a while there of how to handle it.
Thank you, Cliff. Other comments and questions, please.
This is Dr. Laura Fletcher in Berkeley.
Yes.
What do you foresee the individual medical practitioners playing in the future? How do we create a bridge between this collection of public health data and physicians evaluating and treating individual patients?
That's a great question. Dr. Jackson, do you want to take a first shot at that?
It's been very difficult in the past for the clinician to really give people advice. And over again, I remember folks who would have their homes treated with pesticides or who were on a high fish diet or other kinds of things. And just availability of knowing what the benchmarks are. What's the 50th percentile, and am I in the 95th or 98th percentile? That's an important piece of information for the patient and for the doctor. At times, we might not be able to say much more than, you're really high and you may want to change your diet or your work practices or something else, but we really don't have the data yet to interpret this. But it's biomonitoring that will actually enable us to do the studies in larger populations, not a single individual, where we can say, it looks like there's a cause and effect here between the levels we're measuring and the symptoms that are being reported in this population. So the one thing I've been surprised by is I'm always surprised. What we predict we're going to find, when you actually go out there and collect real data, you find that the models that you go into it with don't always hold up, and you're surprised in both directions. I'm just going to put another quick point, because I think it's a subsequent discussion for this group, which is we need to think deeply about the use of nanotechnology, and many of the agents that are being used are not biodegradable. And if there's been any lesson out of the biomonitoring, it is that molecules that perdure, that stay around for a long time, often end up being problems.
Yes, I think we absolutely should explore that. Other comments and questions, please.
This is Asa Bradley. Just to respond a little bit to the last question. The issue you raise is one of the main concerns of the primary care providers that we work with in Salinas. And there was definitely a fear about getting questions to doctors and not being able to answer the questions. And I think that is an important issue, and there are efforts to develop, you know, pediatric environmental treatment protocols, and Dick Jackson actually has been involved in that for years, starting in California. That kind of training is important for physicians to be able to understand what information is out there and how to translate it. I think a good example is lead, where there were exposure studies, biomonitoring studies done years ago. A cause and effect relationship was established, and then public health-based benchmarks were established for exposure and response. Right now, for other kinds of exposures that might be similar in the magnitude of effect, there are no benchmarks, but we need to work towards understanding those exposures and what they mean and establishing those benchmarks so there's a clear protocol for people to respond to.
I just want to make one comment myself. As one of the people that Environmental Working Group monitored in the first citizen body burden study that they did, I had, just for example, very high mercury and arsenic levels. And 2.5 years ago, I had a heart attack. Well, mercury is a cardiovascular risk factor. Now, I have no idea whether the mercury contributed to that heart attack, but it was an interesting exploration for me. And as Dick Jackson suggested, I shifted my diet away from fish with a lot of mercury in it in the wake of learning that. Similarly, I have benign essential tremor. Well, both arsenic and mercury are related to tremor. Now, do they contribute to my benign essential tremor, which is familial and has a strong genetic aspect? I don't know. But again, it was that process of dialogue that we've been talking about. So my experience is that in addition to the care with which clinicians are looking at these issues, that people tested themselves enter into a process of inquiry and exploration, which, as Ken Cook and others have suggested, is quite constructive. And most of the people that I know that have been tested have been able to hold the information, not knowing what the relationships are. But as Ken said, the potential relationships deepen the dialogue that we have among ourselves and also with regard to our own health. We are right at the top of the hour, and I thank our speakers and all those who spoke for a wonderful conversation about biomonitoring. Eleni Sotos, I'm turning the end of the call back to you.
Sure, Michael, and I just want to mention, you might want to say a few words about Susan West-Marmigas. I know that Dr. Frumkin mentioned that she's coming on board. I thought you might like to say a word about it. We do have about a minute left.
Yes, I would like to. I thought perhaps you were going to do that, but I'm happy to do it. I'm happy to announce and welcome Susan West-Marmigas as the Director of Health Programs for the Collaborative on Health and the Environment. Susan comes from a distinguished career at Physicians for Social Responsibility and elsewhere, and as Howard Frumkin said, is one of the most widely respected environmental public health leaders in our community. Susan, I don't know if you're on. Are you on and able to speak?
I'm on. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay.
We welcome you.
Thank you very much. You know, it's quite an honor to join Kay and all of you, many of you I've worked with in my role here at PSR and elsewhere, as Michael said, and I'm very excited to join Kay. I think that the last 3 years of growth that Kay has had really positions it with all of us to do so much more important work in the environmental health community, and I'm quite honored to be taking on this new role. So I'll continue to work with all of you, I think, in that role, and I'm excited about it. And thank you very much, both Michael and Eleni.
Thank you, Susan. So as Eleni said, October 12th is the next Chay Partner call on Katrina. Eleni, anything you want to add?
Nope, that will be it. So stay tuned.
Thank you all for being on.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Thank you, Michael.
Thanks, Michael.
Thank you.